Again, the Omerta held. There was no investigation, no accountability, and no word of what sort of injuries the volunteers in the Zaire arm of the study may have suffered. Characteristically, Gallo was unembarrassed, unbowed, and undaunted by this latest setback. The bought and bullied virology community stayed silent about a scandal that would have implicated NIH and provoked unwanted scrutiny of the HIV orthodoxies. 5 years later, Gallo left NCI and established the Institute for Human Virology, IHV, with his two longtime cronies, William Blattner, who served for 22 years under Gallo as director of viral epidemiology at NCI, and Robert Redfield, a military doctor and researcher who shared Gallo's lifelong obsession with HIV and his ethical lacunae. Dr. Robert Redfield. Many Americans will recognize Redfield as Donald Trump's CDC director during the 2020 COVID pandemic. Dr. Redfield and his faithful sidekick, Dr. Deborah Birx, served with Dr. Fauci on Trump's coronavirus task force. Both Redfield and Birx were former Army medical officers who, in the 1980s and 1990s, led the military's AIDS research, a specialty that seems like a magnet for hucksters and quacks. U.S. military documents show that in 1992, Redfield and Birx, his then assistant, both serving at Walter Reed in Washington, published inaccurate data in the New England Journal of Medicine, claiming that an HIV vaccine they helped develop and tested on Walter Reed patients was effective. They both must have known the vaccine was worthless. In 1992, an Air Force medical office accused Redfield of engaging in a systematic pattern of data manipulation, inappropriate statistical analyses, and misleading data presentation in an apparent attempt to promote the usefulness of the GP160 AIDS vaccine. A specially convened Air Force Tribunal on Scientific Fraud and Misconduct concluded that Redfield's misleading or possibly deceptive information seriously threatens his credibility as a researcher and has the potential to negatively impact AIDS research funding for military institutions as a whole. His allegedly unethical behavior creates false hope and could result in premature deployment of the vaccine. The tribunal recommended investigation by a fully independent outside investigative body. Under threat of court-martial, loss of his medical license, and possible imprisonment, Dr. Redfield confessed to angry DOD interrogators and to the tribunal that his analyses were faulty and deceptive. He agreed to correct them and to publicly admit the vaccine was worthless at an upcoming AIDS conference at which he was scheduled to speak in July 1992. Perhaps it was the grandeur of the hall, the microphone, and the audience that conspired to weaken his resolve. Instead of retracting his falsehood, he boldly repeated his fraudulent claims at this and two subsequent international HIV conferences. As astonished prosecutors watched, he then brazenly parroted his debunked perjuries in testimony before Congress, swearing that his vaccine cured HIV. Redfield's bold gambit worked. Bamboozled by Redfield's brazen ballyhoo, Congress immediately appropriated $20 million to the military to support Redfield and Birx's research project. Enraged military prosecutors wanted to court-martial Redfield, but as Public Citizen complained in a 1994 letter to the Congressional Committee's chairman, Henry Waxman, the dedicated budget hikes promised by Congress prompted the Army to kill the investigation, silence its own prosecutors, and whitewash Redfield's misdeeds. By snatching triumph from the jaws of career-ending disaster, Redfield had pulled off the perfect crime. The bold flim-flam catapulted Birx and Redfield into their stellar careers as top federal health officials. Whatever other lessons he learned from the episode, recklessness and mendacity continued to be Redfield's go-to strategies. Gallo's partnership with Redfield became a gold mine for both men. Dr. Gallo told me in a May 11, 2021 email that the Institute of Human Virology's annual budget, the IHV, is in excess of $100 million. A majority of this funding is from PEPFAR. President George W. Bush created PEPFAR in 2003 at Dr. Fauci's urging to coordinate AIDS assistance from all the various federal government, civilian, and military sources. Since 2014, PEPFAR's administrator has been Deborah Birx, who simultaneously served on the board of the Bill Gates-backed Global Fund. In 2017, the IHV's annual report boasted that these two quacksalvers had won over $600 million in grants, much of it from NIH and Bill Gates, since they cemented their lucrative partnership. They seem to have spent the bulk of that loot experimenting with failed HIV drugs and vaccines on black people, including 20,000 residents of Washington and Baltimore, and 1.3 million misfortunates from Africa and the Caribbean. Gallo and Redfield's IHV partnership was a good bet. They had an academic affiliation with the University of Maryland, their own nonprofit to launder grant money from their old NIH, NIAID, and NCI cronies, and a for-profit spin-off that would allow them to monetize their taxpayer-funded discoveries. Their former accomplices at NIH were pumping $200 million annually into the HIV vaccine boondoggle. Moreover, Redfield had an inside track through Birx and through his military confederates to the vast Pentagon budgets for bioweapons and infectious disease. Those connections yielded plenty of federal dough to keep everyone in the chips. Furthermore, in 1998, a new HIV funder appeared, one with deep pockets and a shared obsession with vaccines. That year, the William H. Gates Foundation announced a 9-year, $500 million plan to fund AIDS vaccine development through Gates's International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, IAVI, the predecessor organization to the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, GAVI. IAVI's president, Seth Berkley, Gates's faithful and extravagantly compensated minion, said the plan would fund multiple efficacy trials of AIDS vaccine candidates in developing countries. If any of the vaccines worked even reasonably well on sub-Saharan Africans, they could then presumably be tested in Western countries. Despite Redfield's well-publicized history as a charlatan and pretender, President Donald Trump put him in charge of the CDC at a time when the agency's overarching mission was promoting COVID vaccines. Trump also elevated Birx, a lifelong protege to both Redfield and Anthony Fauci, and confidant to Bill Gates. These three vaccine mountebanks, Redfield, Birx, and Fauci, led the White House Coronavirus Task Force and steered America's COVID response during the first year of the pandemic. The trio, none of whom ever treated a COVID patient, adopted controversial strategies to confine the nation under house arrest, shut down the global economy, deny the public access to early treatment and life-saving therapeutics like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, excite persistent public terror through the broadcasts of deliberately exaggerated death and case counts, and repeatedly tell the world that the only path back to normal is a miraculous vaccine. With minimal scientific support, they imposed draconian quarantine, mask, and social distancing mandates, purposefully or accidentally inducing a species of mass psychosis called Stockholm Syndrome, wherein hostages become grateful to their captors, convinced that the only path to survival is unquestioning obedience. The Gates-Fauci bromance. 2 years after Gates announced IAVI, he summoned Dr. Fauci to Seattle to propose a partnership that, 2 decades later, would have profound impacts on humanity. Dr. Fauci first met Bill and Melinda Gates during that Seattle trip, ostensibly for a conversation about combating tuberculosis. The Microsoft billionaire had invited the NIAID chief to a muster of global health honchos at his 40,000-square-foot, $127 million mansion rising from 40 wooded acres on the banks of Lake Washington. After dinner, Gates culled Fauci from the herd and corralled him into his spectacular blue-domed library overlooking the lake. Fauci remembered, Melinda was showing everyone on a tour of the house, and he said, "Can I have some time with you in my library, this amazingly beautiful library?" And we sat down, and it was there that he said, "Tony, you run the biggest infectious disease institute of the world, and I want to be sure the money I spend is well spent. Why don't we really get to know each other? Why don't we be partners?" Over the next two decades, that partnership would metastasize to include pharmaceutical companies, military and intelligence planners, and international health agencies, all collaborating to promote weaponized pandemics and vaccines, and a new brand of corporate imperialism rooted in the ideology of biosecurity. That project would yield Mr. Gates and Dr. Fauci unprecedented bonanzas in wealth and power, and have catastrophic consequences for democracy and humanity. The Microsoft monopoly. Influence peddling fueled Bill Gates's drive to power from the outset. Gates came from a wealthy family. His great-grandfather made a fortune in banking and left Bill a trust fund worth millions in today's dollars. After dropping out of Harvard in 1975, Gates leveraged his passion for software engineering to launch Microsoft in an era when most Americans still used typewriters. At the time, his mother, Mary Gates, a prominent Seattle businesswoman, sat on the United Way board alongside then-IBM chairman John Opel. In 1980, IBM was looking to recruit a software concern to develop an operating system for its personal computer. Mary Gates persuaded Opel to take a chance on her son. That intervention propelled Gates's fledgling firm into the big leagues and made Gates a billionaire within two decades. Gates's closest boyhood friend and the Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen described Gates in his 2011 book, Idea Man, a Memoir, as a sarcastic bully who in 1982 schemed to oust him and steal his share of their company. Back at work following a bout with cancer, an anemic Allen, depleted by radiation and chemotherapy, overheard Gates conniving with Microsoft's new manager, Steve Ballmer, to dilute Allen's stake. Allen recalled bursting in and shouting, "This is unbelievable. It shows your true character once and for all." Declining Gates' $5 a share buyout offer, Allen left Microsoft with his 25% stake intact, becoming a billionaire when the company went public in 1986. In May 1998, the Department of Justice and 20 state attorneys general filed antitrust charges against Microsoft, accusing Gates' company of illegally thwarting efforts by consumers to install competing software on its Windows-based computers. The DOJ asked the federal trial court in Seattle to fine Gates a record $1 million a day for antitrust violations. Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson ruled that Microsoft had violated the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act prohibitions outlawing monopolies and cartels, saying Microsoft placed an oppressive thumb on the scale of competitive fortune, thereby effectively guaranteeing its continued dominance in the relevant market. Judge Jackson ordered Microsoft to divide itself in halves and divest either its operating system or its software arm. An appeals court overturned that decision. In a settlement, the DOJ abandoned its drive to break up the company, and Microsoft agreed to pay an anemic $800,000 fine and to share computing interfaces with competing firms. Aside from the financial cost, the litigation had blighted Gates's reputation. Judge Jackson complained that Gates's testimony was evasive and forgetful, and observed that he has a Napoleonic concept of himself and his company, an arrogance that derives from power and unalloyed success, with no leavening hard experience, no reverses. The public had seen enough of the trial and of Gates's revealing depositions to share Judge Jackson's revulsion. An online group called SPOGGE gained widespread popularity. The acronym stands for Society for Preventing Gates from Getting Everything. Class action lawsuits filed in 2000 against the company for gross discrimination against African-American workers and for including racially charged messages in its software further blighted Gates's pockmarked public image. Legendary plaintiff's lawyer Willie Gary complained that Microsoft had a plantation mentality when it comes to treating African-American workers, and observed that there are glass ceilings and walls for African-American workers at Microsoft. Gary settled the case for $97 million. 2 years later, European regulators levied a $1.36 billion fine against Microsoft, the highest penalty in EU history. Gates reacted to snowballing popular disgust by lobbying Congress to slash the Justice Department's budget, and by hiring an army of PR firms to soften his image as a ruthless and duplicitous King Baby robber baron. As part of a concerted offensive to recast his public persona, Gates and his wife formed a charity, the Children's Vaccine Program, with an impressive $100 million donation. The Rockefeller-Gates Nexus. A century earlier, America's first billionaire, John D. Rockefeller, had blazed his own wildly successful exit ramp from public loathing, bad press, and antitrust prosecution by launching a medical philanthropy. John D. Rockefeller's consigliere, Frederick Taylor Gates, served as John D.'s chief business confidant and philanthropic advisor. Frederick Gates helped Rockefeller structure his foundation, advising the mogul that judicious disposal of his fortune might also blunt further inquiry into its origins. Practically from his nativity, Bill Gates began coordinating his own foundation's giving with the Rockefeller Organization. In 2018, Bill Gates made the salient observation that everywhere our foundation went, we discovered the Rockefeller Foundation had been there first. At the 20th century's dawn, Rockefeller's sanguinary maneuvering, including bribery, price-fixing, corporate espionage, and creating shell companies to conduct illegal activities, had won his Standard Oil Company control of 90% of U.S. oil production and made him the richest man in world history, with a net worth of over $500 billion in today's dollars. Senator Robert Lafayette excoriated Rockefeller as the greatest criminal of the age. The oil magnate's father, William Devil Bill Rockefeller, was a marauding con artist who supported his family by posing as a doctor and hawking snake oil, opium elixirs, patent medicines, and other miracle cures. In the early 1900s, as scientists discovered pharmaceutical uses for refinery byproducts, John D. saw an opportunity to capitalize on the family's medical pedigree. At that time, nearly half the physicians and medical colleges in the United States practiced holistic or herbal medicine. Rockefeller and his friend Andrew Carnegie, the Big Steel robber baron, dispatched educator Abraham Flexner on a cross-country tour to catalog the status of America's 155 medical colleges and hospitals. The Rockefeller Foundation's 1910 Flexner Report recommended centralizing America's medical schooling, abolishing miasma theory, and reorienting these institutions according to germ theory, which held that germs alone caused disease, and the pharmaceutical paradigm that emphasized targeting particular germs with specific drugs rather than fortifying the immune system through healthy living, clean water, and good nutrition. With that narrative in hand, Rockefeller financed the campaign to consolidate mainstream medicine, co-opt the burgeoning pharmaceutical industry, and shutter its competition. Rockefeller's crusade caused the closure of more than half of American medical schools, fostered public and press scorn for homeopathy, osteopathy, chiropractic, nutritional, holistic, functional, integrative, and natural medicines, and led to the incarceration of many practicing physicians. Miasma versus germ theory. Miasma theory emphasizes preventing disease by fortifying the immune system through nutrition and by reducing exposures to environmental toxins and stresses. Miasma exponents posit that disease occurs where a weakened immune system provides germs an enfeebled target to exploit. They analogize the human immune system to the skin of an apple. With the skin intact, the fruit will last a week at room temperature and a month if refrigerated. But even a small injury to the skin triggers systemic rot within hours as the billions of opportunistic microbes thronging on the skin of every living organism colonize the injured terrain. Germ theory aficionados, in contrast, blame disease on microscopic pathogens. Their approach to health is to identify the culpable germ and tailor a poison to kill it. Miasmists complain that those patented poisons may themselves further weaken the immune system or simply open the damaged terrain to a competitive germ or cause chronic disease. They point out that the world is teeming with microbes, many of them beneficial, and nearly all of them harmless to a healthy, well-nourished immune system. Miasmists argue that malnutrition and inadequate access to clean water are the ultimate stressors that make infectious diseases lethal in impoverished locales. When a starving African child succumbs to measles, the miasmist attributes the death to malnutrition. Germ theory proponents, aka virologists, blame the virus. The miasmist approach to public health is to boost individual immune response. For better or worse, the champions of germ theory, Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch, proved victorious in their fierce decades-long battle with their miasmist rival, Antoine Béchamp. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Will Durant suggests that germ theory found popular purchase by mimicking the traditional explanation for disease, demon possession, giving it a leg up over miasma. The ubiquity of pasteurization and vaccinations are only two of the many indicators of the domineering ascendancy of germ theory as the cornerstone of contemporary public health policy. A $1 trillion pharmaceutical industry pushing patented pills, powders, pricks, potions, and poisons, and the powerful professions of virology and vaccinology led by Little Napoleon himself, Anthony Fauci, fortifies the century-old predominance of germ theory. And so, with the microbe theory, the cornerstone was laid for modern biomedicine's basic formula, with its monocausal microbial starting point and its search for magic bullets. One disease, one cause, one cure, writes American sociology professor Stephen Epstein. As Dr. Klaus Kuhnlein and Torsten Engelbrecht observe in Virus Mania, the idea that certain microbes, above all fungi, bacteria, and viruses, are our great opponents in battle, causing certain diseases that must be fought with special chemical bombs, has buried itself deep into the collective conscience. Imperialist ideologues find natural affinity with germ theory. A war on germs rationalizes a militarized approach to public health and endless intervention in poor nations that bear heavy disease burdens. And just as the military-industrial complex prospers in war, the pharmaceutical cartel profits most from sick and malnourished populations. On his deathbed,